destruction to function. Justice for the human family, we demand it. Justice, truth, freedom, equality's a must. Us decolonization of the planet, so bust this. People be the power, now we build the justice. Pouring at system divinations, how we build the justice. Welcome to planet to the podcast, build the justice. Build the justice, build the justice, build. Is to add on or do away with justice.
Welcome to Building Justice, a podcast by Sacramento State University's Center on Race, Immigration, and Social Justice, also known as CRISJ. We explore critical issues affecting our communities with the hopes of creating a healthier and more just world. Your hosts for today are me, Dr. Danielle Slakoff, and my colleague in the Division of Criminal Justice at Sacramento State University, Dr. Nicole Fox, who recently authored a book titled After Genocide, Memory and Reconciliation in Rwanda. Thank you so much for joining us on the CRISJ podcast. Dr. Fox, Nicole, welcome to the show and thanks for taking the time to be here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. And let's get right into it. I know that you have a very busy schedule and are about to go on a book tour. So first, some of our listeners here at CRISJ may not be familiar with the Rwandan genocide. Can you give our listeners a brief overview of what occurred?
Yeah, so Rwanda is a small East African country that's landlocked. It's about the size of Maryland or Vermont. And in the 1990s was in the middle of economic turmoil and in the midst of a civil war. And on April 6, 1994, the president's plane was shot down, killed the president along with many others who were on board. And immediately afterwards, killings began. 8,000 people were killed on the very first day in very intimate killings, most often by machetes. And people were often killed by people they knew, by neighbors and church members, school peers, community members. And the genocide was very well organized with roadblocks set up so that people couldn't escape. And hate radio was used to ensure that Tutsis, which was the persecuted group at the time, and moderate Hutu, anyone who had relations with Tutsis, were targeted and killed. And during this widespread violence that lasted around 100 days, there was sexual and gender-based violence and environmental destruction. And the world really stood idly by, as well as the United Nations, as about 1 million Rwandans were killed in about 3 months. And so the country really worked to rebuild right afterwards, trying to build in infrastructure that was destroyed and implement different transitional justice and judicial mechanisms. And one of the things that they implemented were memorials and memory projects once these kind of everyday life functions were a little bit more stable.
That's wow.
What takes off.
Yeah, that's, you know, like I said, some of the people listening may not know much about what happened or may have a more cursory overview. So thank you so much for sharing that and giving us that information. So you mentioned your book, After Genocide, Memory and Reconciliation in Rwanda. I would love to know how you came to engage in this work and in this project.
Yeah, that's a great question. I love questions like that because whenever I meet other authors, I'm always curious about what twists and turns happened in their lives that ended up in these books. So I grew up in a Jewish home and we were taught from a young age about memory and trauma and genocide and trauma. And when I was in college, I vividly remember the bombing of Fallujah and organizing with my friends to take buses where like over 100 UC Davis students, you know, took buses over to San Francisco to protest this in this emergency protest and just feeling that power of collective action and what it meant to be part of something and to resist. And as that was unfolding, I was also taking all of these women's studies classes and sociology classes where I was learning about how war and political violence and conflict and also torture at the time affected communities long term, and also the gendered impact of it. And so I think what really hit me there too was to understand that there was never a genocide or a war without rape. And that was something that that really stuck with me. So when we were invading Iraq and Afghanistan, that idea of killing of civilians and sexual violence weighed heavy on me. And so I ended up going out east to do my master's, and I did my master's thesis on intergenerational transmission of trauma from Holocaust survivors to their grandchildren, and kind of thinking about like, how does memory change over time? And then I got interested in Bosnia. So I went to get my PhD in sociology to study Bosnia, actually. Mm-hmm. But on my first day of the semester, on my first class on, I think, social policy for social change, I met, who later became my, you know, one of my best friends in the whole world, a Rwandan woman. And so I met her, and then I met more Rwandans. And over time, I got to know her and more and more Rwandans in Boston. And my interest shifted there. And so Rwanda became a very particularly interesting case for me because of their efforts to memorialize. But it really started with meeting a Rwandan who said, stop studying Bosnia, study us.
That's fascinating. So to the listeners, we are colleagues and I would consider ourselves to be friends, but I had no idea that you meeting a friend was really helpful in kind of moving towards this. And like so many feminist criminologists, you know, that focus on women at the center, I think is really really important, because we know as a field that hasn't been a focus historically. So thank you for sharing that. Like I said, I had no idea. Okay. So what do you think? I know you spent a lot of time in Rwanda and speaking with Rwandans about this issue. What do you think are the key takeaways from your work in Rwanda?
Yeah, that's a great one. And I think there's key takeaways for different audiences from the book. So one of them, in terms of the people who study memory. So the people who study memory think about collective memory as a social construction, right? So the past is really constructed from the lens of the present, right? So it's always changing and getting sculpted from the needs of the present or the political interests of the present. So what I've learned that might be helpful and interesting to those folks, but also really important in terms of thinking about policies as well, is that micro decisions actually add up to really macro changes and macro level narratives. And so what I mean by that is I studied the small decisions that memorial guides or museum guides made about whose story to include and why, or what pictures to include and why. And what I noticed, or who to include in the testimonies and why. And what I noticed is that those stories and those decisions, they become cumulative into what becomes the larger story arc. And that story arc actually really matters, because that's the story arc that the international community listens to, heads of state here, and also other survivors here. And so those little decisions where just one person's left out here or there add up to larger decisions. And when someone doesn't see themselves within that narrative of their nation, they're less likely to want to participate in some of these nation building activities or civic engagement or reconciliation programs. And that can have really dire consequences on a nation that's trying to rebuild after a significant conflict or significant violence like genocide. Mm-hmm. So that's the first one, is that there's importance in studying those micro level decisions because they affect the macro. The second would be to feminist criminologists, and what I would argue for any criminologist, because everyone should care about gender. And that is that genocide is gendered. So women had different experiences in genocide. And this is not to say that women's or men's experiences, one was better or worse. It was all terrible for everybody. But it's important to recognize that the experience of that violence was different. And it was different because there were different norms in terms of division of labor. So women were with their children and had to make decisions on how to die or when to die or what to do because, and they were with their children, and men often weren't. There was also a division of labor. There were also gendered norms, which structured someone's ability to survive or not survive or negotiate with perpetrators or negotiate about participation in violence. And so that just changed the dynamics. And so to ignore that would be to ignore the kind of political economy of violence and the ecosystem in which this all occurs. And so if we ignore gender or pretend that gender neutrality is the way that we want to see that, we miss a lot of really important things about it. And with that, memory is gendered and the aftermath is most certainly gendered. And so that is one thing that I think is really important for feminist criminologists all know that. But as we also know, mainstream doesn't always recall that. So that was something that was important. In my book, I come up with a term called the stratification of collective memory. And this is the process by which memory is stratified. And it means that like certain voices are elevated and others aren't in a situation in which the community is already quite stratified. So for example, and this can have really dire consequences as well for reconciliation and civic engagement. But for example, folks did not want to have sexual assault survivors talk about their experiences in public because it was so traumatizing for the audience, they believed. Mm-hmm. And so that really stratified this collective memory because sexual assault survivors were not put centered, but rather marginalized. And so what this meant is for like a lot of the folks who suffered some of the most horrific violence and still live in these very dire conditions, the stratification of collective memory really exacerbates social inequality, and it kind of makes this memory unrecognizable for them. Mm-hmm. But also what I found is like it's very hard to give resources to a group of people that you don't hear about.
Right.
So their invisibility makes that stratification even more. So they also didn't want to highlight always survivors who had severe mental health problems or lived in significant poverty because those stories weren't uplifting. And so this has like some pretty significant implications for thinking about victimology after atrocity crimes. And then the last one would be for like human rights or folks who are trying to implement peace programs and thinking from like a methodology perspective is the last part of my book interviewed survivors about reconciliation. And so I wanted to know, like, how would you measure reconciliation? How do you think about it? What's it look like? What's it feel like? How do you see it? How would you know when you saw it? And a lot of times reconciliation is measured by these barometers or by the like United Nations Human Development Index. And those are these really great, you know, quantitative measures that do give you a sliver of what's going on.
Right.
But they do also like miss part of what's going on. And so one part of my book really asks is that there's and kind of argues is that there's limitations to measuring reconciliation in this way, and that it can be really helpful to measure it in these like very micro qualitative ways by asking some of the folks who are at the lower end of the social structure. And so what I found is that actually how they saw reconciliation was not by these human development measures as much, but by using the bus together. Like, or knowing that if they got sick, their neighbor would take them to the hospital. Mm-hmm. And so this provides this like really rich insight into reconciliation. And it also shows us how that type of qualitative is also shaped by generation and gender, because you saw a really the safety measure was really, really that folks who were older generations talked about that a lot, or women talked a lot more about forgiveness, and they talked about more about how forgiveness wasn't possible, which is really interesting because that really goes against a lot of some of the social norms that folks assume about women being these like very forgiving, the more forgiving gender, So anyways, those are probably the big takeaways. I hope that wasn't too long.
No, not at all. I have so many follow-up questions, but I'll start with this first one.
Yeah.
For your first takeaway, you mentioned sort of how certain stories were chosen and sometimes it was just one person deciding this.
Yeah.
Did you see, you mentioned gender as being one lens through which some people were chosen and some weren't. What other, you know, attributes did you notice for people maybe whose stories were not told?
Yeah. So we talk about this a little bit in the book. There is a huge trauma problem when I was there. And I think it's decreased a little bit since I was there, but there's a fear in it. To be honest, it's a, you know, it's a valid fear of the audience having what could be thought of in America as like a post-traumatic stress response, but it's a trauma response. I'm not a doctor, so I would not diagnose it by any means, but it's a trauma response in which, you know, someone gets a flashback, they start like shaking, they're screaming. But the challenging part about that is that it can spread. And I even went to commemorations in which that got very out of control very fast. And so there's a real fear of allowing people's testimony to contribute to a situation in which that would happen. So, but sometimes what that means is not allowing any testimony that talks about sexual violence, poverty, mental health, trauma. You know, anything, any of those. And so then you're slowly kind of marginalizing testimonies until you're getting, for the most part, you know, a male survivor who's flourishing in genocide's aftermath. And so, which also we can't underestimate the power of international aid too. And how guilty international actors now feel for their inactivity and how that story may also bring in aid.
It's so interesting.
It's really complicated.
No, I was going to say, it's so interesting because you think about our museums and how they're curated and even there, like which stories are told and which aren't. And I think you're tapping into something really powerful and interesting about how history is made and told. And, you know, the genocide in Rwanda wasn't all that long ago, and you're already seeing the testimonies that didn't make it.
But there's also testimonies that made it. And I do want to draw attention to that as well. I wrote an article about this and also mentioned in my book, there are museums that discuss, or there are memorials that discuss gender-based violence. And in some ways, Rwanda also is like a beacon of light in the sense of that, because there are so few models of that. So in such a short period of time. So in 1994, Andrea Dworkin actually wrote this amazing article. I think that got published in Miss Magazine. I hope I'm correct, but I'm not 100%. And it's titled Looking for the Women. And essentially she went to the US Holocaust Museum and couldn't find any women. And she went to the archives and there were no archives about women. There was no archives. And it wasn't until like the 90s that there were actually books about Holocaust and women. So like in some ways, Rwanda's like ahead if you're comparing it like that, because it took like 50 years. But I think that sexual violence comes with so much shame that that in particular is really hard to have in public spaces.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks so much for sharing that. It's so fascinating. So this topic, of course, is undoubtedly heavy, talking about trauma, violence, sexual assault. As researchers, we rarely get trained on how to deal with vicarious trauma that can sometimes occur when we are working and hearing the stories of survivors. I was just wondering if you could share with our listeners about your experiences with vicarious trauma and how that was for you as you engaged in this work on the genocide.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I really appreciate this question because I actually wrote about this in my appendix and it's my favorite part of my book, but I had reviewers not like this particular part because of it. And I think you're absolutely right in that scholars are expected to like advance theories and talk really authoritatively about facts and develop these like very precise methodologies. And they're not supposed to like analyze themselves, and those that kind of like agonize over the ethics or their positionality or the emotional labor risks like being called sloppy, you know,
right.
or too emotional or
too involved.
Right. And really what I think this is actually people who make those assertions are really complicit in a very gendered historical pattern of marginalizing women's scholarship and any work that appears feminine, as well as like the emotional labor that goes into knowledge production. So I think thoughtful qualitative research and any type of research that is on violence requires that. And I think studying people's lives come with like a grave responsibility. And especially if you're inserting yourself into someone's life that's a post-conflict zone, you know, there's a certain level of emotional and ethical work that has to be in there, because you're witnessing people's past and you want to make sure that you're not inflicting any level of pain that you can help when you're interviewing them and you're interviewing people who have suffered so much. There's this great quote by Rebecca Campbell who studies sexual violence, and she says that we can't do any harm. It's something like, we can't do any harm because like plenty of harm has already been done. And so I really experienced that, and I want to have more conversations about that because I think that brings better researchers. So I thought a lot about my positionality as a white woman, as a white Jewish woman, American woman, young, doing these interviews. And so I'm happy to talk further about that. But I also did have some experience with secondary trauma, and that occurred for years afterwards. So I went to so many commemorations, and for the folks in my book, I interviewed them multiple times throughout the calendar year. So I got to know them very well so that we could build up rapport and trust. And I ended up visiting many of them for years, for over a decade afterwards. And I went to the burials of their loved ones and commemorations. And on one particular day, I had been to like 5 funerals in the past 5 days. And then I had gone to a long commemoration where that trauma that I told you about had happened. And the next day I was like, I think I do need a day off. So I took the kids I was living with to the pool, and I kept hearing screaming like I did from that commemoration, but no, there wasn't anyone there that was from a commemoration. Mm-hmm. And I just kept hearing it, and I would turn around and hear it. And I was having nightmares about the genocide, and I didn't have any kids at the time. And so I told one of my best friends who's a priest in Rwanda about it. And he's like, you're having secondary trauma. Like, you need to chill out and like take a couple days off. So I did. I have to say, I still have nightmares. So there are certain boundaries now I put on my work. Like, I don't watch any documentaries about Rwanda. It's too real to see the country. But there were also a couple stories that women told me about their children. And mm-hmm. they were so, so horrific in how they died. And one was like, you know, there was a couple where I like cried with the women because I had known them for months and and interviewed them multiple times and then heard these stories, which I won't disclose here. And there was a one where I like actually vomited after the interview, and it was so horrific, but my brain blocked it out, and like, which was amazing for years. And it came up when I had my first child. I remembered the stories, and I remembered the stories when I had my second child, and every now and then I'll remember them again with my kids. And so it's weird how your brain remembers those.
Absolutely. And it's interesting how our brains, you know, try to protect us, you know, and try to block that out. But it sounds like you had very visceral experiences of remembering, you know?
Yeah.
And like I said, I think as qualitative researchers, this just kind of gets skimmed over. Is like, oh, it's just the price you pay for doing the work. And I think that there's something really troubling about that. You know, I think that it's part of the work, you know, and so we should be supporting people and making sure that they're taking care of themselves too.
Right. Right. And I also just remember thinking, feeling so guilty, because I was like, gosh, I didn't live through this and I'm feeling all of this, and they lived through it. So like, I need to get it together, but it doesn't work that way.
Right. Thank you so much for sharing that. Yeah. And I know for so many people listening, we have a lot of students and potentially people considering graduate school and research. You know, it's important to hear this and to kind of instill what can happen, you know, when you do this research, but still how important the work is, you
and
know.
There's also ways you can learn to mitigate it. You know, you can have a really good mentor that understands. Exercise was just like so key to me kind of taking out some of that energy out of my brain. And there's so many ways you can kind of figure out tools.
Absolutely. So I would love to know where your work is going from here. I know you just finished writing this book. You're about to embark on a book tour. But if you wouldn't mind, you know, looking a little bit into the future, you know, where is your work going from here? Is it along the same vein, or have you shifted a little bit?
Yeah, this is such a fun question, because I'm excited for my book talks, but I have been working on this book for so long that I'm more excited about my future project.
It happens sometimes like that. And that's another thing listeners might not know is sometimes it takes a while for your research to see the light of day.
Yes.
And so you've been in it for years, you know?
Decade.
Yeah, a decade.
So this is great. So one of them is with a colleague of mine, Dr. Holly Nyeth, and we're analyzing a different dimension of the genocide in Rwanda. We're talking to the people who saved other people.
Okay.
And it's pretty amazing. So the rescuers. And so we now have the, like what we think is the largest qualitative data set of Rwandan rescuers to date. So we've
interviewed
over 170 of them. We have like these 3-hour rich interviews trying to figure out what made folks save others when so many people didn't save. We're hesitant to think it's a personality trait, but rather looking at like, what were these contexts or what were their socialization like that changed it? The second project is with a colleague, Dr. David Cunningham, and we looked at the long legacy of the 1979 Greensboro massacre. And we looked at the interviews that people who participated in the Truth Commission that occurred in 2005, their interviews in private and their testimonies in public, and how their narratives changed in those spaces. So that's a really fun project. That's actually coming to a close. We just got our article accepted. So I'm hoping to do more, because we have great data. And then the last one's with Dr. Alexa Sardino, which is actually very connected to this project, where we're looking on the aftermath of sexual violence in America and healing through the memorialization, looking at the first sexual assault memorial in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and interviewing folks who visit that. So, I mean, that says a lot there. You know, we were talking about the silence and you know, the fact that it's 2020 and that's the first memorial in America. So
absolutely. That is so interesting. And it sounds like a lot of the work is still connected to some broader issues. I'll say one last question, which is, you know, Chris Jay, the Center of Race, Immigration, and Social Justice, is focused on these global issues on an international scale. And I'm curious what you feel what the role is of social justice in talking about Rwanda. Do you feel that that's at the root of this book?
Yeah, I think it's really important for so many reasons. I mean, the survivors that I talk to, I often, and the rescuers too, to be honest, I say, you know, I'm a teacher. I talk to a lot of students. What do you want them to know about Rwanda? So, I mean, if my students are listening, they'll say, like, I talked about Rwanda in the classroom. And there's a lot of things to say about Rwanda. And one is talking about how important it is to intervene in violence. And that violence can be, you know, all sorts. That could be, you know, racial injustice or, you know, sexual violence or all sorts of various forms of violence that happen on a continuum mm-hmm. on college campuses or in other contexts. So I think one thing I've learned from Rwanda is how important that bystander intervention is mm-hmm. and that it can save lives.
Absolutely.
And then also how important it is to let people share the stories and make space to share stories of what they've endured and how important it is for people to bear witness and receive those stories.
Absolutely. I was just thinking when I was processing everything that you've shared today about the power of listening mm-hmm. and how you've really talked about that so much today. Right. So I really appreciate you, Dr. Fox, talking to me and talking with the Chris J listeners about this. We hope that our conversation today sparks ongoing conversations around understanding, empathizing, and motivations to join the struggle for a better future for all. Thank you so much for being here, Dr. Fox, and thank you to our listeners for being here as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
All the penalties and the rewards based on the actions. Now, time for building justice. Building justice. Time for building justice.